I love the passage you selected out of the big book because it describes everything that I know about Chris. And with that, please help me welcome Chris S.
My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. A member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything I have in my life today. It's given me a life. I've been reborn in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't say enough about it. I love AA, and it's just the best thing that's ever happened to me. My sobriety date is November 19th, 1998, and I'm a member of the Miracle Group in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. We have a great group. We meet at 8 o'clock at St. Mary's Church Cafeteria in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And we get there to the 8 o'clock meeting at 6:30. And we get busy doing what we do. We read from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And the women usually pair off and the men pair off or whatever with sponsees and sponsors. And we study the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And we usually have something to eat and make the coffee, and everybody gets together in the fellowship of the Spirit, and then by 8 o'clock we're ready for a meet. And we laugh and we joke and we kid around, but at 8 o'clock when the bell sounds, we're drop-dead serious about staying sober. And I'm very grateful to be a part of that. It's why I'm standing here, you know, strong sponsorship, strong home group, commitment to service, all these things that have helped keep me sober and got me sober. I'd like to thank the committee for having me over. I feel like I used to live in southeast Louisiana. Well, kind of. I lived in Destin. And in the summertime, every other tag in Destin is Louisiana. You know, you guys kind of live over there in the summertime. And so, every other weekend, Jimmy's over. But thank you for inviting me, and it's an honor and a privilege, and what a deal. You know, I'd like to say Norm had a great story last night, and we were talking about so many losses and so many things that were tragic, and how he's been able to take that to put in God's hands to help other people. It's what a tremendous power of example. And I thought, I was thinking, you know, I never had all these reasons to drink and, you know, excuses. I just drank. And I got to thinking, wait, that's Norm's story. My story is my story. So that's what I'm going to talk about. On the page 20 of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that you may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us came so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you're curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. And that's why I'm here this morning, to tell you what happened with me. I remember I was sitting in the Okaloosa County Jail. And I had done a 5-year prison sentence of a 10-year sentence, and moved to Florida after being released. And I was sitting in the Okaloosa County Jail for my second parole violation on that, and I knew I was gonna. I'd been out a year and violated my parole twice. I was going back to prison in Georgia. I had an interstate warrant for that. Come back to Florida and do a 2-year suspended sentence. And then facing another charge, which they were going to give me 1129, which is another year. So I'm facing 7 years. I knew I was going back to prison, going back to jail one more time. But I had made a commitment to stay sober. I got to the point of desperation and asked a power greater than myself for help. And here I am sitting in the Okaloosa County Jail, and I'm doing what I'd learned. I'm trying to study the book. We're having these little meetings in the jail. They didn't have AA in the jail, so a few of us got together and would sit right there in the cell or the day room and have an AA meeting. And I remember looking at a flyer, and the flyer had a correspondence with different people. It said treatment, contact so-and-so, corrections, contact Mark B. And I'd heard this guy's story, and I was at a detox, pretty well mangled up, and he came in and shared his story. And he shared about being released from prison on parole and violating it and going back, and being released on parole and violating it and going back, and being released on parole a third time and going back. I couldn't dodge or duck all that because I was sitting in detox, you know, under the radar from a parole violation. But there was a guy in the cell with me, and I told him, I got out the flyer and I said, when I get out of here, this guy's going to be my sponsor, Mark B. And he said, oh, no. He said, don't do it. That guy was my sponsor. And he said, what happened is I got drunk and he came over to my house and he beat me up. And I just shook my head and agreed with him. But inside I was thinking, that's the guy from... If I have any hope of staying sober when I get out of here, it's going to have to be a guy that'll come, a big guy. He's kind of big like Paul, you know. This guy will come over and beat me up if I go to start drinking. Maybe I'll be able to stay sober, you know. I mean, that's how I knew I was pretty hopeless. And that sounds crazy, but that was my mindset. And come to find out, most of you guys know Mark and DeHalty, and they're such a blessing in our lives. And here and where we are, and there was a little more to it than the story. Mark went over to pick this guy up, and he had been drinking and doing some other stuff, and he was in a rage, and he swung at Mark. Then Mark beat him up. So there was a little more to it than that. But when he said that, I made a commitment. That was going to be my sponsor. And that's what I did. I remember when I got out, that's exactly what I did. But what got me to that point was, I began drinking at a very early age, and I think I was lured into drinking. I couldn't find my regular big book, so I brought one of my substitutes, and here it is on the front, on the first cover. My mother gave me this picture. I looked at the date. I'm 9. I'm wearing a Budweiser shirt, you know? And it was because it was the late 60s, early 70s. All my cousins and older brothers and sister and neighbors, we grew up in South Miami, kind of an ethnically diverse neighborhood. We had Greeks that lived next door with 11 kids, say no more. We had Cubans lived next door on the other side, and they were always having a party or siesta or whatever it was. For anything, they'd find a reason to have a big party. And that's what everybody did, you know. And is I think at an early age like this, I thought, well, this thing called life is tough. You know, relationships, marriages, work, school, all these things are tough. But you have a big blowout party on the weekend. Everybody gets drunk and they're pushing each other in the pool and dancing and having a good time. And it makes everything okay. As a kid, that's what I saw, you know. We'd watch it every weekend. You know, they'd go to somebody's house. My parents had a pool, so they'd come over to our house, and they'd get drunk and throw each other in the pool. And midnight, they'd be skinny dipping, and we'd be looking through the fence. And, you know, it was just the lure of that had me before I even drank. And like a friend, Bobby, says, I was just sitting duck for alcoholism. And what happened is a buddy of mine went down to the local golf course, and we called ourselves helping the golf pro clean up golf carts and police around the area. What we really did was we went in and unlocked the back window so we could come in later and steal beer. And Richard and I stole a case of Miller High Life beer, 16-ounce cans. And we gave 12 of them away. But Richard and I sat down to get drunk with these 12 beers. And Richard drank one, I drank 11. You know, that's just what happened. I don't know what that was all about. From the very first time I drank, I drank 11 beers before he probably even had the one down. You know, I just, that's what I did. I don't know where that came from. A lot of things developed that first night that I drank that followed me for the next 20 years. I was 14 years old. I woke up in a sand trap at 2:30 in the morning, vomit in my hair, black eye, shirt torn, missing a shoe. I have absolutely no idea what happened the night before. I was laying on a tennis court watching the whole world spin around. It was the last remembrance I had. And I remember waking up in that sand trap and shaking the sand off and thinking, wow, that was cool. And I couldn't wait to do it again. I had no idea what I did, but I knew I had a good time. And it wasn't long. It was the summertime, and it wasn't long after that, a day or two maybe, we have a case of Black Label beer, and we're up in the woods, and we're just getting smashed. And I did not, you know, I came to AA. The reason I drank was my father was this, and my, you know, and I blamed everything. I was a big victim. But I had a good upbringing. And if anything, my parents had older siblings, and, you know, they had to work and do all that. If anything, my parents spoiled my little brother and I rotten, you know, gave us everything they didn't have. And but I can't blame all that on my parents because I had a good upbringing. But what happened for me is I just took a drink of alcohol, and Bobby also said alcohol brought out the alcoholic in me immediately. I mean, I've got alcoholism on both sides of my family and just chock full, and then a lot of reasons why I'm an alcoholic. Doing the family tree thing and trying to figure out, you know, what was my origin. I'm the classic American Heinz 57. I'm a mutt, but I'm every ethnic group that should not drink. You know, I'm American Indian, I'm Irish, I'm Italian. I'm every ethnic group that shouldn't drink. That's me genetically. You know? But what happened is I just love the effect produced by alcohol. And up until that point, I was a pretty good student. A's, B's, occasional C. And when I went back to school after the summertime, D's, F's, occasional C. And you know, and that's just what happened. I played baseball and football and track and all these things. I went back to school. I quit track. I got thrown off the baseball team. I got thrown. That's just what my drinking did. In the solution chapter, it talks about what we have to recover from alcoholism is a whole new way of thinking, a spiritual experience of take attitudes and actions and emotions and push them to one side, and a whole new set of motives and conceptions begin to dominate us. That's what happened when I drank, because I was like my Aunt Polly says, you were a good little boy. And she'd question me, you're not going to do this and do that and end up like the... No, ma'am. I was a good little boy. But when I took a drink, ideas, emotions, and attitudes that were once the guiding force of my life were pushed aside. And a whole new set of conceptions and motives began to dominate me. And that was doing what I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, and it included alcohol. And a lot of things happened that night. I say it was like a broken record. And one was the way I drank. And I'm not going to say every time I drank from here that point on out, I drank straight to oblivion. But most of the time I did, because that's just, I tried to put as much alcohol in my body as fast as possible, like they were never going to distill or brew another drop. And I don't know what that was about. But right past social drinking to oblivion. And some other things that happened from the first night I drank that followed me for the next 20 years, too. And one was the first night I drank, I got in trouble. The kid we gave the other 12 beers to threw up all over his mom, and his mom called my mom, and we had to march over and apologize for stealing the beer. It didn't do much good. You know, I didn't really care about the consequences, especially that. But drinking began to cause a lot of trouble right off the bat. You know, some people develop alcoholism on a bar stool in a period of years. They become alcoholic. And then others were just a mess from the beginning, and that's my experience. And so I got in a lot of trouble because of my drinking. And, excuse me, right from the beginning, I began to get in a lot of trouble and have heavy consequences for my drinking. And right from the beginning, I began to be numb, let's say, or callous to those consequences because I love the effect produced by alcohol. You know, I say the first time I broke some furniture in your house or groped your girlfriend or fell out in the yard, you said, you know what you did last night? You did this. And I go, wow, I'm sorry. I'm really. The 20th time I did that, and you said, get out of here. And my thought was, I didn't want to come over here anyway. You know, the first time I rode in the back of a police car, I hid my face and didn't want anybody to see me. The 20th time I rode in a police car, I'm waving at everybody, could have cared less. I mean, I just became callous to the consequences that my drinking caused. And so I got in a lot of trouble because of my drinking, and I developed a pattern of like a broken record. It was like, dun 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 dun, bam. And the record would skip, and something would blow up, and I would be physically removed from alcohol. That was the only way I quit drinking. I would wake up in jail. I'd wake up in an emergency room with tubes in my nose and, you know, and I'd come to, and I was a pretty good old boy sober. I'd say, it was a mistake. I'll control it better. I'd tell them whatever they want to hear. They'd say, well, you need to, and they would release me, dum da da dum 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 da da da, bam. And that's what happened. I began this broken record that just followed me for the next 20 years. And I like to say right here, right now, that this is not the comprehensive picture of alcoholism. You're sitting here saying, well, I didn't do that. This has nothing to do with alcoholism. The first page of chapter 4 talks about what alcoholism is. If you can't control the amount you take once you begin, or if you can't quit, you're probably alcoholic. And page 30 says this is basically the same thing. We're men and women who can't control our drink. But this is just my experience. I was just wide open. You know, it was either locked down or drinking, 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 drinking. And before I had a driver's license, I flipped a neighbor's truck and got a DUI and written a string of charges. They said, let me see your driver's license. I said, I'm only 15. So I'm in trouble. I mean, then once I got a driver's license, it was really bad. But a good student up until this point. I love school, everything about it, I guess. But I was suspended, expelled, and asked to never come back. And really, I didn't care. You know, I came from a good family. My parents wanted me to graduate high school. My parents wanted me to be this or that. I mean, they were professional people. And here I am, a long-haired little punk that's in jail. And they were ashamed of me, and I wasn't ashamed. I just didn't care. I love what I was doing. And I'd hear this a lot when I first got sober. Nobody ever wants to grow up to be an alcoholic or have these problems. I did. I mean, I looked up to all the kids. You know, my cousin Patty, I was 10 years old, picked me up, took me to see Carlos Santana in the Miami baseball stadium. She had a psychedelic Volkswagen Beetle drinking wine out of a big thing. You know, I mean, I just looked up to all of them. I just, wow, I can't wait. And so what happened is I began at our local detox. They have a sign that says, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. That's a story of mine drinking. I kept drinking. I kept getting in trouble. And the progression of alcoholism, they say it's a fatal progressive illness. It gets worse, never better. Well, the consequences of my drinking got worse, never better. You know, I wasn't getting slapped on the wrist anymore. I was going to jail. And I'd get out of jail, and I'd go to the state work camp. I remember we went to the state work camp there. We had moved from Miami to a small town right outside of Atlanta. And they sent us to the work camp where we got to basically work out on the road. And it's you've seen Cool Hand Luke or whatever. It should be embarrassing and life changing, and you should think about things and change. They put me in the cell with a guy we used to hang out at the beer joint with, and he said, "Oh, it's not so bad. My girlfriend will throw out a bottle of vodka, and we'll go out and cut bushes on the side of the road, get drunk, have a good time." It was like putting us out in a hunting camp in the woods and saying, "Y'all stay out of trouble now." And it was, and you know, Norm talked about it last night. My sponsor talked about, and this part I couldn't relate to, but in my warped mind, I kind of could. Going into the service, my sponsor went into the service and served his country. I remember we were standing around a campfire one night, and this buddy of mine says, "Gene, you were in the Marine Corps, weren't you?" He said, three years. He said, "Hell, Tom and Chris and I had done at least 3 years in work camp." And that was my thought. My service to my country was cutting bushes on the side of the road and cleaning up garbage. I mean, that's Marine Corps, chain gang, you know. He was proud. We were proud. So instead of being humiliated and humbled, it was just like, yeah, that's what we did. Yeah. And so if nothing changes, nothing changes. I always do what you always do. You always get what you... I had more DUIs. I went back because of more DUIs. Back then, it wasn't like it is now. I sponsor a guy with four DUIs in Florida. He'll never get a driver's license ever in the state of Florida. I had four DUIs before I was 18 years old. I mean, I just DUI after DUI. Got two in one night, you know. And the cop says, "Don't be driving anymore." And I'm cutting donuts in the high school lawn. And we'll have to take you down again, you know. It was just a slap on them. Most of my DUIs were not, "Sir, have you been drinking?" My DUIs were, I'd hit three or four cars in the beer joint parking lot. 3 or 4 miles down the road, the sheriff would finally find me where the skid marks went off by a bridge, and I'd flip the car two or three times, and they'd arrest me for DUI, leaving the scene, destruction of property, whatever, a string of charges. And that was par for the course for me. And so I got in a lot of trouble, and it got worse, and it got worse, and it got worse. And I got in some big trouble one night. I can really relate to my sponsor. We talked about this. His fight broke out over a girl. I didn't even know the girl, but I got right in the middle of it. You know? That's the story of my drinking. It got crazy, and it was a long story. We went to Atlanta about a month ago, and I showed my sponsor and Dale, a friend, the scene of the whole thing, and it was like, it was a shootout at the OK Corral, and I got all of a sudden I got a violent charge. I got an aggravated assault charge. Nobody got hurt, or other than their feelings, maybe. But I got in some serious trouble. I went to prison. And it was humiliating and humbling, and they shave your head, they put you in there and spray you down, and standing there with a bunch of other guys. And then those couple of hours are over, and they throw you in the cell block with a bunch of inmates, and it's and it was humiliating for a few hours, you know. And then it's crazy, you know. By this time, I'd been in a lot of trouble. I'd been in a... I never talked about this in my story, and somebody at detox the other day was talking about being in and out of mental institutions. I was locked down on a psychiatric... They call it an observation hall for 10 months one time. And I never talked about being in a mental institution, locked down, thorazine out, and then four-point restraints. And I was like, wow, I never talked about that before. But that's what happened, and that's... what continued to happen. And, you know, it was almost like attorney, housewife, whatever. The hand that I was dealt was alcoholic. And that was okay. You know, you got your hand, I got mine. Sure, it came with trip to jail, whatever, wrecking cars, fighting and all this. Whatever. When I get out, I'm going to have a good time. You know, it was worth the consequences, I guess. That's what I thought. I couldn't picture life without alcohol. And so, but what happened for me is, as I got out of more trouble, I got married briefly to a girl I dated in high school. I didn't know how to be married. I knew how to drink, and I knew how to do what I wanted to do. We were married a couple years. It was a couple years of my life that I stayed out of trouble because I had a babysitter. She would drive me around drunk, or she'd keep me out of trouble or keep me out of scrapes or whatever. And I remember I was in a treatment facility, a Georgia State thing, and she came to visit me with divorce papers, and I was like, wow, after all we've been through. You know, later on, I got sobered up. I thought, how in the world did she put up with it for that long? You know, I mean, and, oh, I hated her mother, you know, my mother-in-law at the time. If I was her mother, I would have had me, like, knocked off or something. I mean, my brother said she was a nice girl until she met you. But I got in more trouble. That's when I went to prison on this. I got a traffic ticket. It was the selfishness and self-centeredness of my drinking. I was probably spoiled, and I was lazy. Didn't want to work. So I do whatever I have to not to work. And that would be import-export business. That would be stealing cars. That would be whatever. I mean, my parents didn't raise me that way, but it's what I did. And I got in trouble for a traffic ticket or trafficking, something like that. They gave me this 10-year sentence in Georgia penitentiary. I remember my father came over and visited me. He said, I've got this connection, get you any prison you want to go to. And you ought to go to this one where your grandmother could come down and visit you. And then, so I said, okay, that sounds good to me, whatever. And I remember going back to the cell block and telling the guys, yeah, I'm going to Central Correctional Institute in Macon, Georgia. And they said, oh, no, that's a disciplinary camp. That's where they send the worst of the worst. You don't want to go there, you know. And I remember, you can't write you can't phone or anything. I remember writing a letter, Dear Dad, please get me sent anywhere. But and then before the letter got to him, it was like, EF286829, report to book in or transfer. And here I go to one of the most violent prisons in the state. And I got to visit my grandmother, though, you know. I remember I was in the intake, and I heard all these bad things. And there was this guy, he was on the United States bobsledding team, and he was bigger than Paul, and he's standing there. He was in the goon squad, keep everybody in. And I said, is this place as bad as they say it is? He said, it's probably worse. I said, oh, Lord. I said, can I transfer out of here? He said, yep, you can, after you've been here 2 years. And I was like, oh, man. And it was exactly 2 years to the day that I transferred out. But what happened is I was paroled in 1994, and my parents had moved to Florida. And what do you do when you're 30-something years old and everything you own's in half a garbage bag one more time, home to mama? My parents took me in. My father helped me buy this little car from a neighbor, helped me get a job over in Sandestin area. I went over there. I was out 30 days, got a DUI on the Mid Bay Bridge. Deputy said I was scraping one side of the bridge to the other, 80 miles an hour. I don't remember anything. I just woke up in jail. And bam, one more time. And before my parole papers got from Atlanta to Tallahassee to Shalimar, our local office, I'd violated it. My parole officer didn't know what to do. Remember Animal House? They put him on double secret probation. He said, we're going to put you on double secret probation or something. I said, what does that mean? He says, you can't get in trouble with alcohol. I said, what does that mean? He said, if you drink one beer and get in trouble, that's a problem. If you drink a half gallon of vodka and don't get in trouble, it's okay. You know what I heard. you can drink a half gallon of vodka. And then, yeah. So I was out another 90 days maybe, and I flipped the car, you know, string of charges. My brother was coming over to get me to take me to detox because I was on a run. And he didn't show up in time, so I decided I'd drive myself. I'm driving down the road in the rain, flat tire, no lights. Deputy goes to pull me over, so I decide, well, I've had a little bit too much to drink. I'll outrun him, then get to detox. I about killed myself. I had flipped the car, and I remember going around the corner sideways, and there's my brother and his family coming to take me to detox. And my nephews and nieces pointing, there's Uncle Chris. And they followed the carnage down the street. And the deputies, I remember floating through the air and thinking, I got to run to get to detox. I come crashing to a halt. I jumped out and I ran through a briar patch. And then when the deputies got me out of the briar patch, you know, they did the little Rodney King treatment on me. They like beat me to death before they threw me in the ambulance. And I could remember my nephews going, look, Uncle Chris. And it was horrible. They remember that to this day. You know? And you think of Uncle Chris and drinking, that's what they think of. And that's a good thing, you know, because they hadn't seen me drunk in a long time. But that's what got me to the county jail. That's what got me to the point that, you know, on page Bill's story, Bill talks about at the very end of his drinking that that he was there on the bottom of the staircase and thinking about jumping out the window sash and all, and that was and it said that the next morning the doctor came with gin and sedative. And the next day found him drinking both gin and sedative, and it soon landed him on the rocks, and he feared for his sanity, and others did too. That's my experience. Right at the end of my drinking, I got involved with some really high-powered things that I had done in the past, but it landed me on the rocks. And I just got to a point. What happened for me is what happened, what it's like now is it the theme of this, the singleness of purpose, over and over and over. From the 15 years old when I'm at my first AA meeting, I heard in AA was all these old people, they're about my age, all these old people were talking about, this is what we did, this is how we drank, this is what happened, and I could relate to all that. And then this is what happened. We got to a point of desperation, and we finally reached out for help. We asked a God, a power greater than ourselves. We asked a woman or a man to sponsor us, and then our lives transformed. And I sat there at that meeting as a kid thinking, well, if it ever gets bad enough, I can go to AA. Stick that in the back pocket, and you know. And thank God for that. You know, thank God that they said that's what their experience was, because all throughout my drinking, that's what happened. I came to AA for all the wrong reasons. They had cookies in prison, and it looked good for the parole board. But when I got there, you people came in and said the exact same thing. You carried the message to the alcoholics. And thanks for that information. If it ever gets bad enough, I'll have to do the same thing. Glug, 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 you know. But thank God for that. Because my experience is, on page 30, it said we learned. We had to fully concede to our innermost selves. Well, my learning took a long time. And I hope it doesn't take that long for anybody else. But that's just, I'm a hard-headed alcoholic. And it took a long time for me to learn that I had to fully concede to my innermost self. Because that's the first step in recovery. I could admit, well, I'm an alcoholic. My life's unmanageable. Give me another drink. You know, that was in the ninth grade. I knew all the other kids didn't drink a pint of vodka and go in the homeroom, but I did, you know. And so I knew I had a problem. And I remember this old guy in detox said, do you think if God himself came out of the heavens, stairway out of the clouds, came right down here right now, could he help you with your drinking? And I wasn't prejudiced against God or whatever. I said,
well, sure. He said, then why don't you let him? And he had me. I mean, well, the reason I didn't let him is because I didn't really want to get sober. You know, I hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what we did when we got to a point. You know, my sponsor came in. That's the picture below my, you know, the mug shot. I'm beaten up, stitches in my head, my collarbone's broken, my ankle's broken, I'm hobbling around. And my sponsor comes in and tells his story. And he got to a point of desperation that he couldn't go one step further. He heard a woman share her experience. He went back to a homeless shelter and got on his knees and asked God for help, or a power greater than himself for help, because he had left God in Southeast Asia. Thanks for the information. If it ever gets bad enough, that's what I'll do. So I hobble back, you know, and back to jail and back to. But thanks for the information. And it should have got bad enough, but it I don't know, because it didn't get bad enough on the inside. But what happened is my parents, my family, everybody on the planet Earth said, "Go away," you know. And I went away, and I reached a point of desperation. Norm talked about this last night. I got to a point. I was standing in a somewhere in New Orleans. There's train tracks that go underneath. There's this bridge trestle, and I was going to jump off of it and kill myself. And I remember thinking, you can always go back to AA. And I was like, oh. Not only did AA ruin my drinking, AA ruined every part of my life, now I'm going to kill myself and can't even do that because of AA. You know, and that's where I had to get. I had to get to this point. You know, my buddy Tom I from North Carolina says it the best. This thought of joining the Legion of the Damned, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, wasn't the you know, it just this hell on earth experience is the way I thought it would be. Every second of the day, I'd be wanting to drink, but I couldn't drink because I was in AA, and you know, no thanks. I likened it to let's make a deal. Remember, what was his name? Monty Hall. The long microphone, the lady in the chicken suit, and the man with the bag on his head. You know, I'm standing down front, and he's like, okay, Chris, behind door number one, we've got your sad, pathetic life of alcoholism. Beaten and dragged and kicked and drugged down the street and every horrible thing that's ever happened to you, direct result. Oh, yeah, by the way, it's chronic progressive illness that gets worse, never better. Or door number two, the spiritual path that we're all taking, where every hope and dream and ambition and anything good in your life can ever be imagined is behind that door. What's it going to be? Door number one or door number two? And I'm like, well, what about door number three? And he's like, there is no door number three. It's door number one or door number two. And I'm, well, can't I just cash out and go home? And he's like, no, you passed that point a long time ago. This is the decision. And that's a brutal decision for an alcoholic to think of. You know, and it says it in the fourth chapter, to live on a spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death. Let me think about it. You know, I remember sitting in detox. I'll die drunk in a ditch before I go to AA. And I meant it. All those losers up there, my dog died, my boyfriend or girlfriend left me. But now I'm happy, joyous, and free because I worked the steps and called my sponsor. Ha, ha, ha. No. But what happened is I got to a point where that hell on earth existence and that Legion of the Damned sobriety shuffle was more appealing than the life I was living. You know, the worst thing I could imagine, being sober in AA, looked more appealing than where I was at. You know, I remember getting on my knees and just saying, God, help me. There was a bunch of stuff in a row, and I just got on my knees because thank God of the singleness of purpose, and that I finally took filing cabinet back there somewhere and just said, like my wife says the best, driven to my knees, said, God help me, I can't go on like this. And what happened was I got up and I went to one of those meetings where those losers were, because I knew if those losers can't help me, I don't have a hope. If those steps, those losers are working, can't help me, I'm doomed. If the sponsor those losers say they have can't help me too, it's over. And
That was my experience. And I found out, I felt sorry for these old guys that sat around this one meeting. This one guy drove an old beat-up truck, and another guy was I felt sorry for him, wore the same clothes. I thought they were bums. One guy was a dean of Dartmouth College. Another guy was a Air Force colonel. He just liked the old beat-up truck, you know. And so what I learned was all these losers weren't losers after all, you know. They were just trying to stay sober and trying to... But what happened was, parole officer picked me up, took me to the county jail, and my journey began. Because when I got out, I had been to my home group many times. Our home group is the home group that everybody talked about in the area. Our home group was the one that were all the real alcoholics congregated, those fanatics. I remember I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning, and there's a big room, and on the coffee pot over here, there were the fanatics, and they were our home group members, and they were saying, don't drink, you need to begin to take a little, you need to start prayer and meditation, service work, and I'm like, whoa. And then over on this side of the room, and the other coffee pot, they're saying, hey, don't listen to those fanatics. You know, we didn't come in here to lose our individuality. Just don't drink. And I'm like, okay. Come hang out with us. You know, we do a lot of fun stuff. You know, they were all doing other things. And I was like, wow, this AA isn't that bad. And then there I am on death's door one more time. And I couldn't stay sober with those people. So where did I go when I meant business? To the fanatics. And I remember pulling up to the meeting on Tuesday night, and I pulled up in this old beat-up car, and I heard the Halties laugh the best. Everybody's out on the front porch. Like I said, having a good time, shooting the breeze. But when the bell rang, they were dropped dead serious. I knew that. That's why I was there. But they were up on the porch laughing, and I just couldn't get from the car to the front porch. I remember one night getting in the car after hearing her up there laughing and just saying, you know, the heck with them. I went and got drunk despite them. You know, I'll show them. But that's where I went when I meant business. And I got out of jail. My big first miracle in AA, I was going through all these reasons I got sober and all this other day. The reason I got sober is I got tired of going to jail. Got tired of going to the penitentiary and the nut house and the places that I went because of my drinking. And but what I did was my first miracle was the 7 years I had to do. My parole officer, who later came into our home group and got sobered up because he was checking on me so often, and he had he wrote a letter for me, and the district attorney wrote a letter for me. My 7 years turned into 10 months, 11 months. I was like, wow. Because I knew it was because I wasn't drinking. They were coming in the jail cell from working all day, and they'd have booze they'd sneak in. And they'd be drinking all around me. And I got a sheet over my head doing my four step in the jail cell. You sure you don't want any? And I knew if I took a drink, it was over. Life as I knew it was over. So I didn't drink, and I stayed sober. And I made a commitment to do this because I'd asked God for help before I went. 7 years turned into 11 months. And I was like, thank you, God. And I ran out. I made no bones about it. I knew it was because I had made a decision. And I knew that this was my last. I knew, like Tom says, at a cellular level, that it was over. And that I better get right into this thing or I was going to die. You know, I went straight to Mark B. on the corrections thing. And I said, I need some help. I'm dying. And he said, I know you are. I've been watching you for a long time. And he said, I'll tell you, I don't know if you can get sobered up or not. And that's great news to hear. Know how Roland felt. He says, because this is a battle between you and God. And I can't get you sober. I can't keep you sober. This has to be between you and God. He said, but if you can do 5 things every day, you and I guarantee you and I can stay sober together. That was a promise, you know. And I was like, yeah, what are those 5 things? You know, and he said, get up in the morning and ask God to keep you sober. Go to a meeting every day because you drank every day.
He said, don't drink. If you think of drinking, ask God for help. Call somebody. Get some help. Just don't drink or do any substitute. He said, you've never been accountable to anybody in your life. He knew me better than I knew myself. He said, I want you to call me every day. I still call him every day, you know. And he was right. Never been accountable to my parents, school teachers, principals, warden, nobody. And he said, and thank God at night. And I said, yeah, but I've heard there's more, there's steps, there's service, da, 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 da. He said, just do those five things. Because I've been in and out so much, he just watched me in the beginning to make sure I was doing what I said I was going to be doing. And I remember it was a couple days into it. I was going to drive up to the local. Now, that's what he said. He said, now let me ask you something. He said, do you have a driver's license? And I said, no. He said, didn't you just pull up in that old car over there? And I said, well, I only drive to meetings. And he said, let me ask you, you're on parole. You're on probation. You're on community control. You don't have a driver's license. Is it tag in your name? I said, no, it's stolen. Stolen tag, no insurance. And I'm driving around. And he says, don't drive. And I think, there he goes, trying to control me. He just didn't want me to go to jail. You know, I have a fighting chance at staying sober. I remember I got in the car. I was going to a meeting the next day. And I could hear, if you want me to be a sponsor, don't drive. And I went, oh, man. And I backed up, parked the car, and walked to the meeting. I got there 5 minutes before it let out. I was mad. I was like, but it dawned on me later. It was the first time in my life I'd followed directions of anything. And that's what happened. I began to follow directions, and grudgingly at first. My wife says, he's up at 3 o'clock in the morning, watches these movies on the cable channel. And I thought I'd be in trouble. My sponsor said, how do you get all those channels, 130 channels? I said, I used to install cable TV. I said, I just steal it. And he said, you ask God to keep you sober, but you steal your cable TV. I said, yeah, I can come over and do yours too. You know, until it's objectionable, it's not objectionable. I had absolutely no idea why he was wanting to tell me to not steal my cable. And what's that got to do with not drinking? He told me, start paying your cable bill. And then I had 17 channels instead of 130, and begrudgingly I started paying it. What happened? 5-6 years into sobriety, my wife and I go to buy a house. We didn't even know we had credit. A buddy of mine pulls my credit up and goes, you got a 750 Beacon score. I said, is that good? He said, man, that's great. Alcoholics Anonymous. The amends process of paying back what I owed. And the first time I paid an old bill, they all jumped on board. Hey, you owe us too. You know, but you know, I began paying them. You know, and my wife and I are going to buy a house. A three-time ex-convict, ex-gangbanger, and, you know, going to buy a home, a mortgage. And Hurricane Ivan, there was a hurricane in the Gulf, and what happened? They said, well, the lady that approved it is no longer with us after all these hurricanes. Now we're going to have to redo this whole thing, and we don't think it's going to happen. And we said, well, we tried. They said, unless you've got one bill that you can show you've paid consistently for 5 years, we can sell you a house. You can get a house. So the power bill was in my name. Then we moved from Destiny. It was in her name. And then this, that, and the other. And then we had the other rent that we paid for. The last one, I knew it was in her and mine. Call the cable company. You've been a faithful member of the cable company for 5.5 years. I said, you're kidding. They faxed me a thing over. He said, you're approved. following directions that I didn't want to follow. I had absolutely no idea why I should follow him. I could go over and hook his cable up too. But okay, I'll start paying a little $30 every month. We own a home, you know. Two-story house in suburbia, you know. AA, you know. That's it, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's absolutely nothing, you know, that I've done. People say, my best thinking got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish my best thinking could have got me here. My best thinking got me cutting bushes on the side of the road with rattlesnakes. You know? God got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and God got me sober. AA is the best thing that ever happened to me. I don't know when I'm supposed to stop. Y'all tell me. Let them. When? Five, 10 minutes? Terry, when am I supposed to stop? Okay. What happened was my sponsor says, hey, weren't you in the detox a few times? I said, oh, yeah, because I had started going in with regularity. And he said, they got a meeting over there on Saturday night. Why don't you go? From the first or second week I began staying sober, I've been in the detox every week since then. What a wonderful thing. It's really hard to take a drink when you're sitting in a meeting and you're reading the preamble and somebody falls out on the floor and has a grand mal seizure and they stick a stick down his throat and carry him out on a stretcher. Yeah, I was in there one day and this guy I was sponsoring comes in and I said, Ray, you look like you got the devil in your eyes. And he said, I got the devil in more than my eyes. He had a pattern of doing some same behaviors over and over, and we all warned him against it, and he continued to do that. And I said, well, here's my card. Call me when you get out of detox. I walked out the front door. The detectives busted in the back door, carried Ray away. An hour later, they came and picked me up and wanted to know what happened that night. And I said, what night? And they said, with Ray. And I thought it was the AA police. I said, well, he was sitting back and he looked kind of crazy. And I said, yeah. And then what happened? And I said, I told him, you look horrible, man. You're going to die. And they said, yeah. What happened then? And he said, Ray just shook his head and started crying. Yeah. And what happened then? I said, then the meeting was over and I left. They said, no, what happened after? You know, good cop, bad cop. Ray got drunk and he was accused of murder, killing a girl in a motel. And that's what happens, you know. The nicest guy you'd ever meet, you know. Murder? No. Not Ray. Somebody else maybe, but not Ray. Could that have happened to me? If it could happen to Ray, it could happen to me. You know, I could name 20 people since I've been sobered up. You know, prison, dead, you know, maimed, sitting in the nursing home wearing diapers. I was in detox with them, wearing diapers. It's a bit, you know, I say that at detox sometimes. They go, can't scare an alcoholic. Couldn't scare me, but that's just the reality with what would it. But my sponsor got me involved in service work. I couldn't go in the prisons, you know. When I remember one of the last times I was arrested, the deputy said, oh my God, is that guy's NCIC still tickering off? Tickered off for 30 minutes. Thing was going down the hallway. My record was too bad to get into the prisons. They made me the corrections secretary. And I started taking notes, and I became the corrections chair. And I started going in the felony court program and the juvenile justice thing and getting involved in corrections. I love it because, you know, I got a message for those guys. Over in Slidell, we went into prison over there in the St. Bernard Parish and all those hairy-legged convicts out there. And we all got up and talked to them, and Jimmy and Mark and all of us got up and talked to them, and they're crying. It was like, you're crying. We're fixing to leave you. You know, what a message, though. What a wonderful thing to be a part of. You know? What a wonderful thing. Alcoholics Anonymous. To know that it can work. You know, I correspond with Ray. You know, he went to prison. He a lot of things happened to him in prison. Now he's at our local prison, and we correspond and might even become where we can visit and that kind of thing. And I know that Alcoholics Anonymous can work in his life, and he doesn't have to spend the rest of his life in the penitentiary. And what a wonderful thing to be a part of, you know. The guys I sponsor guys, and you know, it's usually the guys. I remember I couldn't stand this guy, you know. And he was just so full of himself and knew it all. It was me all over, you know. And he asked Mark, who should I get to be my sponsor? I respect you and AA. And he pointed at me, and I was like, oh, no. He goes, ask him to be your sponsor. And I was like, you know, and what he did is the same thing I did to Mark. You know, he had all these theories and how he felt and what he thought. And I just get so tired of hearing it. I go, shut up. I don't care how you feel and what you think. I want to know what you're doing. You know, what are you doing? And he didn't like that, but he started doing it, you know, and he began to change, you know, and what a wonderful thing to be, the bright spot of my life. I actually like him now, you know, other people like him. When you see him coming, it's like that. A friend of mine, Teresa, used to say, when I'd see you walk in the door, I'd clutch my purse. I was thinking, what? Me? I'd go to the bathroom, I'd carry it with me. And I thought, I'm a nice guy. Why would I? But that was the same thing with a, you know, what a, and you know why? Because the first 5 years of my sobriety, I got to our home group that meets at 8 o'clock. I got there at 6. I put on the coffee. And everybody knew that I was going to be there. I was there religiously. 5 years, Aaron started doing that. You can get there at 6:03 on a Tuesday night, and it's open. And the coffee's being made because Aaron's there, period. You know it. And that's what we do. And our lives begin to change, and we pass it on to others, and their lives begin to change. And what a wonderful thing to be a part of, you know. I would say, I'm not hurting anybody but myself, you know, drinking, you know. My mother hasn't had to travel 3 states away to come see me in a penitentiary and be strip searched in 7.5 years. That's a big deal. Ask her, you know. They haven't had to take a collect call from me. I'd be in Baton Rouge or somewhere doing AA, and I'll collect call my parents. They'll go, he's not in jail, is he? You know, but they know I'm okay. You know, I mean, they hated me, and we have a wonderful relationship today. You know, everything in my life that I have today, like my sponsor says, is the direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, being transformed, being reborn in Alcoholics Anonymous. What a wonderful gift. You know, I got married early in sobriety, and Dolores and I got married. We've been married 7.5 years, 7 years? Seven. 7 weeks was a long time for a girlfriend or wife or something. 7 years. When I got sobered up, I got a job. I got the same job today. Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember I was sitting in the county jail, and this guy said, this isn't in the book, but just put every job you've ever had, and whether you got fired because of your drinking or not. I had 42 jobs. I can remember to the best of my recollection. Got fired from every single one of them for my drinking. Every relationship I ever had with him, he said, put dumped or got dumped beside it. I got dumped from everyone because of my drinking. You know, the patterns of the inventory process. And what a wonderful thing to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everybody talks about the steps. I can't leave the step one. No, I'm just kidding. The steps changed my life. I love talking about the steps as it originally happened in my life, but more important, as I work them and live them in my life today. The sixth and seventh step, just, I did them early on. Whatever. Totally didn't understand. I guess I did, because I quit stealing, and I quit doing a lot of horrible things, and because I was helping others. But later on in sobriety, I saw where six and seven could keep me sober, as things became objectionable. and things deep down inside came up that I had to deal with. And I was on shaky ice. They said, 5 years, Tom says it the best, you'll show up, you'll grow up, or you'll boogie. And that's what I said, not me. I'm going to prison. You know, on Monday night, I go to the prison. On Tuesday night, I get there early, make coffee for my home group. Wednesday, I go to detox. Thursday, I go down to a treatment center with my sponsor. Friday, go to another meeting with my sponsor. Saturday, go out with my sponsor and friends. And Sunday, we go to another treatment center. 5 years, I'm not going to have any problem whatsoever. Woo! You know, 5 years, I found myself on thin ice. And it was... I can't believe I'm going to another meeting. I just go to AA and work and AA. And then I had to be reminded, this is no joke. This is life or death. And I got to step six, and thank God that my behavior had become so objectionable that I had people around me that loved me enough to hurt my feelings. Just like in the beginning when they, you don't understand, I'm different. Well, the problem was they all understood, and they all let me know it. Thank God in sobriety, the people around me loved me enough to let me know it. And it was people very close to me that looked me right in the eye and said, I don't know what you're doing, but you're fixing it. No, they said, you must like jail. You must like penitentiary. It was DeHalty. She said, because I don't know if you've drank yet, but you're fixing to drink because your behavior is becoming objectionable. And it makes me sick. She turned around and walked off, and I thought to myself, now that's somebody that knows me. You know, because I got to this point in complacency, and some things had began to take over my life that I was blindsided with. But I was willing to have God remove them. And I prayed for God to remove them. And through the seventh step and the twelfth step, God removed them. And I had, just like from the beginning up in a small period of time, a zest for this thing like I'd always had. And I love it. You know, the inventory process. And our friend Don was so special with that and continuing to do that. And it's just changed my life. And it's a wonderful thing to be a part of. And I'll just close with that and say that AA has just been the best. It's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. It's given me everything I have in my life today. And that's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you.